My friend Chester Elton has written a number of books with his co-author Adrian Gostick. Now, his best-known book is a New York Times bestseller, and it's The Carrot Principle, because in short, carrots are better than sticks. But he'll say himself that his most important book is Anxiety at Work. Now, I had dinner with him last night, in fact, and when I was speaking to him, he laid out some disturbing statistics about the rise of anxiety at work, particularly among younger people. Here are a few of them. 50% of millennials have left a job because of a mental health issue, which is terrible, but better than the numbers for Gen Z or Gen Z, where 75% have left for a similar reason. Here's one more. 90% of employees didn't feel safe talking to their immediate supervisor about mental health. What that told Chester, and it tells me as well, is that empathy is now indubitably an essential quality of leadership. It's not woo-woo, it's not quote-unquote touchy-feely in that can we just get on with the business sort of way. Now, driving empathy is a profound core skill. Curiosity. And to steal from a restaurant menu I read recently, is curiosity two ways. First, curiosity outwards to that other person. Who are they really? What's going on for them really? What matters to them really? What are they feeling really? You can see why I love a good coaching question. But then there's also curiosity inwards towards you. Who am I really? What's going on for me, really? What matters to me, really? What am I feeling, really? What am I feeling, really? Welcome to Two Pages with MBS, the podcast where brilliant people read the best two pages from a favorite book, a book that has moved them, a book that has shaped them. And as a heads up, there's a brief discussion of child sexual abuse in the first part of this conversation. Mark Brackett is a psychologist, he's a professor at Yale University, and he's the founder and director of the Yale Center for Emotional Intelligence. Now, he and his team are on a mission.
We're a team of 60 people who are scientists and practitioners who kind of run around the world trying to get people to talk about their feelings and do all the science to prove why that matters.
Lots of us, and honestly, I'm one of them, are not particularly eloquent when it comes to talking about feelings. It can seem tricky twice over, awkward for the one talking and awkward for the one listening as well. So our first impulse is often to shy away from talking about the difficult emotional things, to spare those around us and ourselves. But this attempt to spare one another can lead to greater suffering. Mark understands this viscerally.
I had abuse in my neighborhood. There was a pedophile, sadly, living on my block who victimized many, many children. I was one of them. And I was silenced as a kid because I was threatened that if I shared what was happening to me, I would be hurt, my family would be hurt. I had two parents who loved me dearly, but they had their own emotional challenges, right? They were both in a second marriage. They had both had kids from prior marriages. Finances weren't great. My mother had terrible anxiety. My father was this tough guy from New York. And so I never really got a chance to talk about who I was or what my feelings were as a kid.
Rather than being silenced, what might have been different if those children had been empowered to talk about their feelings? Mark can attest to what a difference it can make.
My uncle was an amazing person. He was a band leader at the hotels in New York State in the evenings, and a school teacher by day. And he had discovered something magical, that feelings were the missing link in children's education. And by wave of a magic wand, he was going for a graduate degree in my hometown, and he'd stay with us on the weekends. And when I was around 12 or 13, we would sit down and, as they say, shoot the breeze. And he was the first adult who asked me how I felt and really listened. And so, hence, my entire career is built on that early experience.
What a gift, and what a powerful homage to his uncle Mark's career has been.
So, think about what happens when you don't have the permission to feel. Right? You're trapped with your feelings. You can't be your true, full feeling self. You don't have strategies to express, you know, or manage your feelings. And so life is not good, you know, when you're the only one who cares about your feelings. And, you know, people have argued with me, permission to feel, like, who gives you permission and why do you need permission?
Right.
Well, the truth is, for many people, society does not give them the permission to be their true, full feeling selves.
Yeah.
And so I think that it's a human right for the adults who are raising kids and teaching kids to create the context, the home environments, the school environments. I think it's a human right for bosses and big companies and small companies to create the space for people to be their true feeling selves.
I'm thinking about what it would mean for me to have permission to feel, and thinking to that time when your uncle asked that amazing question of you, how are you feeling? And something must have cracked or opened up for you. What vocabulary did you have to talk about your feelings? You know, how did you know what to say when somebody asked you a question like that?
Well, again, now you're getting back into, you know, the deeper work, which is that, so here's the irony of the whole thing. My uncle was building a program called the Feeling Words Curriculum.
Oh, man.
And literally was challenging the New York State Reading and Social Studies Association at the time to rethink the way they taught history. And the history should be taught through the language of feelings so that students could identify with the experiences of these characters that they had nothing in common with.
Right.
And so what was really interesting is that my uncle secretly, I think, because he knew my trauma, would ask me to type up some of his lesson plans, because I was like middle school typing back then. And he'd give me words to like write lesson plans on around alienation and despair, as well as commitment and elation. And then we would sit down and have these conversations around these words. What do they mean for me? What do they mean for him? What do they mean for society? And so I think simultaneously, he created the space for me to be open and honest about my experiences, which, by the way, is critically important. You know, his facial expressions, his body language, his vocal tone, the sparkle in his eyes when he spoke to me, his pauses, right? All of that. And then I had the language. And honestly, without the language, it's pretty much impossible to get your needs met.
Right. What a gift. This man is in your life. And what, if I can ask, and this may be too personal, so feel free to skip the question.
I'm letting it all out these days. So
I hear you. What were those emotions that you were permitted to feel? And perhaps as a follow-up question, because I can imagine some of the darkness around that, how have they transformed, or have they transformed?
Yeah. So, I mean, I think first is just to share the feelings I was having as a kid, which were shame, fear, anxiety, disgust, hatred. There were strong, severely unpleasant feelings, confusion, overwhelm. And imagine what it's like to be a kid who doesn't have the labels for those feelings.
Right.
You know, so what happened? You asked that earlier. You eat your feelings, you cut your feelings, you cry your feelings, you bang your head against the wall, your feelings, you act out. You know, the list goes on. We don't need to get a doctorate in psychology to learn how not to use our feelings wisely. That I can tell you.
Yeah.
But when you're given the permission to feel like my uncle did for me, I think the first thing is that you feel free and that you feel safe and you feel valued and supported and non-judged.
Yeah.
And those are big things.
Why is non-judged important in this space?
Well, because the judge is always the knower, right? I say there are emotion scientists and there are emotion judges. And the emotion scientist is in learning mode. The emotion scientist is curious. The emotion judge is the knower, is the teller, is the person who attributes things to you and doesn't know anything about you. So, you know, in the courtroom, fine, we need judges. But when it comes to building and maintaining healthy relationships, I'm going to say the judges should stay home.
I appreciate you setting this up for us and telling us the journey for you. Will you tell us about the book you've chosen to read for us?
Yeah, so Lisa Feldman-Barra is just a pioneer in psychology and has been a mentor of mine throughout the years. And so she wrote a new book called 7.5 Lessons About the Brain. And what I like about this book is that it's a deep and quick read. Since I have zero attention span these days.
You and me both.
Books that I could get through. And also her work so aligns with mine that she's more of a basic scientist than I am. I'm more of an applied scientist. And so I really like to use a lot of her basic science to demonstrate the things that I think are important for education.
And which two pages have you chosen to read?
So I want to read the opening of chapter 5, which, by the way, coincidentally, kind of is a nice segue from me talking about my Uncle Marvin. And it's, your brain secretly works with other brains.
Oh, I love that.
We humans are a social species. We live in groups. We take care of one another. We build civilizations. Our ability to cooperate has been a major adaptive change. It has allowed us to colonize virtually every habitat on Earth and survive and thrive in more climates than any other animal, except maybe bacteria. Part of being a social species, it turns out, is that we regulate one another's body budgets, the ways in which our brains manage the bodily resources we use every day. You've already learned how caregivers help their babies' brains to budget these resources efficiently, or badly, in the case of Romanian orphans, as those little brains wire themselves to the world. Well, the mutual body budgeting and rewiring continue long after those little brains are grown. For your whole life, outside of your awareness, you make deposits of a sort into other people's brains and body budgets, as well as withdrawals, and others do the same for you. This ongoing undercover operation has pros and cons with profound implications for how we live our lives. How do the people around you influence your body budget and rewire your adult brain? Remember that your brain changes its own wiring after new experiences, a process called plasticity. Microscopic parts of your neurons change gradually every day through tuning and pruning. For example, branch-like dendrites become bushier and their associated neural connections become more efficient. This remodeling job requires energy from your body budget, so your predicting brain needs a good reason to splurge. And a great reason is that the connections are used frequently to deal with the people around you. Little by little, your brain becomes tuned and pruned as you interact with others. Some brains are more attentive to the people around them, and others less so. But everybody has somebody. Even psychopaths are dependent on other people, just in a really unfortunate way. Ultimately, your family, friends, neighbors, and even strangers contribute to your brain structure and function and help your brain keep your body humming along.
That's wonderful, Mark. I love that line you towards the end there, everybody has somebody. What's the significant idea here for you? What's most important?
I think the most important is that we're co-constructed as people, and we, as much as many people in America think it's all about me, 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 me.
Right.
It's really about the we and the us.
Mm.
That, and I think it, for me, what's I think most important is that it creates a co-responsibility. It right. means how I behave, how I treat people actually impacts their development. Mm. And that's a big responsibility and one that we should take seriously.
I'm not a parent myself, but I totally get that there's an intuitive sense of that immediately with raising kids, which is like, you know what, I've got to role model stuff so that my kids see how to be in the world and interact in the world. It feels like a much broader responsibility when you're like, no, it's with everybody. Everywhere you yeah. act with everybody influences their brain and they influence your brain. What are the implications of that for you in terms of how you show up in the world, Mark?
Well, you know, it's why you need to keep reading in your life to remind you, right, of these things, because you get lost in your day to day and you become very self-absorbed. But, you know, as I said earlier, you know, my Uncle Marvin was the absolute most important person in my life.
Yeah.
Because of that permission to feel component to my life. And I'll tell you a funny story. So when my book came out, I'm on tour, I'm giving all these presentations, like hundreds of them at a time. It's like, I'm going nuts talking about my stuff. And I never really got into my uncle. Like I would talk about him briefly, but I never really told my full story about my own childhood yeah. and how my uncle helped me. But that's what I wrote about in the opening of my book. People that's were curious. Right. So the long story short is I'm giving a speech and I tend to do this exercise, which is, I ask people, like I can ask you, Michael, did you have an Uncle Marvin? Was there an adult?
Yeah. And yes, I can point to three adults who tipped me left instead of right in my life, and it made all the difference.
Awesome. So a lot of people say they do, but many people say they don't have that Uncle Marvin.
Hmm.
But this is what happens. I'm giving this speech. I'm talking about my uncle. And I ask people that question. All of a sudden, some guy pops out of his seat. And he's like, Mark, are you talking about Marvin Moore, the sixth grade social studies teacher from Catherine Mountain? And I said, I am. And he's like, well, your uncle was my Uncle Marvin 45 years ago.
Wow.
And I said, tell me more. And of course, I asked him to wait after the presentation was over to meet with me. I cannot tell you how much this guy remembered about my uncle's teaching, the facial expression, the body language, the way he spoke, the way he taught. It blew my mind. But I share that with you because he caught me off guard.
Yeah.
Because at the end of our conversation, he looked at me and he said, so Mark, obviously your uncle did a lot for you. Mm. I said, yeah. And he goes, well, I'm curious, for whom are you the Uncle Marvin? And you know, I'm a workaholic and I'm introverted, and so those two things together, you know, don't work well, and often you know, to be that Uncle Marvin for as many people as I could be. But it really, as you can see, this is a year ago or so, it stuck with me.
Yeah.
And it's made me much more aware of my presence and much more aware of how much I give and offer and support.
Yeah. As well as actively choosing who you are present to and give to and try and be your best self to, I'm curious to know what it means in terms of, I guess the word is curating the people around you. You know, how do you decide not to, who you don't have in your life? And how do you think about that? Is that part of the mix as well?
Certainly is. It's tricky though, right?
Mm.
Because, you know, firstly, it depends on like, if this is a workplace kind of thing, you know, and you're both adults and someone's really mistreating you, you know, it's different than, you know, a parent and a child, right? Yeah. Or a teacher and a child. So, you know, what I say is that emotions are signals to approach or avoid. people's facial expressions and body language and tone all send signals. I want to be with you. I don't want to be with you. I like you. I don't like you. I respect you. I don't. But here's the trick. When it's an adult-child relationship, no matter what the feeling is, it's always approach. Because it's a child's human right, right, to be nurtured in a healthy environment. And I find that some people are taken aback by that because, you know, teachers say to me, well, you know, there's a few kids in my class that drive me out of my mind. I just can't stand them. I'm like, eesh. It's your job to find a way, right, to reach that child. It's not the child's job. And obviously the same thing works with parenting. So, you know, again, it depends on the relationship, you know, and the age. In adult to adult relationships, like in the workplace, I think getting out of a toxic environment is probably one of the most important things you can do for your health and wellness.
Right. Part of your work, Mark, talks about feelings and it talks about emotional intelligence. And can you just intellectually kind of make the connections between what are feelings? Are they the same as emotions? Or is there a difference between those? Is it just a synonym or is there a technical difference between feelings and emotions? And then what is emotional intelligence and what is the role of feelings in the what I imagine is a different thing, which is emotional intelligence?
Sure. You know, for most of us in our daily conversations, I would say, let's not go crazy about this because it's not really that important.
Right.
Scientists want to get, you know, granular and specific and precise in the way we use language. And there is some benefit to it. So an emotion, right? A mostly automatic response to some kind of stimulus that's in our head or in our environment. It causes shifts in our thinking, our behavior, motivates us to do things. Oftentimes, almost always based on our life experiences.
Right.
It's an appraisal. It's not a thing. You know, what makes me afraid may not make you afraid. What brings me joy may not bring you joy. But if I appraise something as having danger, I'll be fearful and so will you. Because we've constructed that word to mean that. Yeah. A feeling, you know, is a more private experience about your emotions. So, you know, you were mean to me. You know, I don't feel like being your friend anymore. I don't feel like being around you. That's the feeling piece.
Okay.
And then emotional intelligence is really about using emotions, moods, and feelings wisely. So it's being aware, or I have a model called RULER. So recognizing my own and others' emotions.
Yeah.
Am I accurate? Am I judging your facial expression, or am I learning about you and knowing how you feel? Am I aware of my own feelings, understanding them? What's the difference between jealousy and envy and anger and disappointment? 99% of the people that I interact with, which are tens of thousands a month, don't know these differences.
Right.
Labeling emotions, having that language. Is it anger or is it peeved? Is it irritated or is it enraged? Is it down or is it hopeless? Is it happy or is it ecstatic?
Yeah.
That's RUL. So that's the experience of my own and others' emotions. Then there's the E and the R. Expressing emotions. Knowing how and when to express my feelings and emotions with people.
Right.
You can't always say what you want when you want to, because you might, you know, there are boundaries. There are some norms in the world. And then there's regulating emotions, those strategies that we use to help us keep our feelings that are helpful, shift the ones that are getting in the way.
Let me ask you, I want to come back to RULER because it's a really helpful model. I particularly want to talk about recognizing emotions because that first step feels so important. And I'm asking for myself here. I'd just like to be more fluent around that. But before I go there, just kind of connecting to this really helpful model, what are the myths about feelings that drive you nuts? Because there must be a whole lot of clickbaity LinkedIn articles or whatever else where you're like, I just wish people would stop believing this because it's just not actually the way things are. Is there something that drives you nuts?
I think there are two primary things. The first is that the goal is to be happy all the time.
Right.
You know, there are more books on happiness than there are cockroaches in New York City. And it drives me out of my mind. And I'm not saying that happy is a bad thing. My goodness, I could use a little bit more happiness. But if I strive to be happy all the time, it's you know, we call that toxic positivity. Also, right. It's not real. And then I actually have three now that I think about it. The second is that there are good and bad emotions.
Right.
We talk about all emotions are information.
Yep.
And I think the third, which is kind of related to the second, is that we see some emotions as weak. So for example, if you're I'm a male leader, and if I'm feeling anxiety, right? Oh, well, that means you can't be a good leader.
Right.
Because that means you're, you know, incapable of managing. And I think it's the opposite, actually. I think as someone who has had anxiety for much of his life, I'm much more empathic to people's emotional lives.
Right.
Also, it assumes another problem, which is my fourth one, which is that I could write another book based on our conversation here, which is that we confuse our temperament and personality, you know, with our emotional intelligence.
Well, can you say more about that? Yeah.
Yeah. So just because you have the proclivity to experience strong emotions like anxiety or frustration or anger doesn't mean you're not good at dealing with it or labeling it. Just means that you have a tendency to feel that way more. As a matter of fact, the argument can be made that people who are more prone to experiencing emotions in intense ways have more practice to deal with them.
Right. More masterful at it. Well, thank you. And I can just see, you know, your new book, which is like the 7.5 things that people get wrong about feelings. And maybe you can co-author it with Lisa. It'd be perfect. So going back to your lovely model ruler and particularly recognizing emotions. So I would say that I'm a fairly placid guy who has a wiring of not feeling strong emotions.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm really curious about that to go, because is that actually a wiring or is it something that needs to be nurtured and strengthened and grown? And my assumption is getting better at recognizing emotions would have me be more facile about feeling a richer spectrum of stuff. I'm curious about whether you're like, am I just wrong here? And if I'm not totally wrong, where do you begin to strengthen your ability to recognize emotion?
All right, so a few things going on there. One is, I don't think anything we can say these days is fully wired, you know, because it's very hard to separate your development from your genetics. They're inextricably linked, as we now know, right? We're social creatures where our brains are being built from our interactions with others.
Yeah.
So that's that. When it comes to recognizing emotions, however, Michael, we have to be specific here. Is it about reading your own emotions, reading other people's emotions, or are you talking about labeling, you know, and accurately identifying them?
I feel like the signals I get from my own emotions are weak. And actually the real thing is, I would like to feel stronger emotions, more sadness, more anger, more joy, some examples, I'd like to kind of feel like a little more on the kind of the ends of those spectrums, rather than feeling like I'm more central and less up and down.
Well, you've made the first step, right? You have the desire.
Yeah, exactly. There we go. I'm feeling desire. I've got all the emotions done.
I think you just got more animated by saying that.
Yeah, it's true.
Don't be the judge, right?
Yeah.
So for yourself either. And because there's no judgment about this. This is where you are and where you want to be. Yeah. And you have to set goals and find strategies to help you get there. So one is maybe start, learning emotion words that are in those extremes.
Right.
Right. And start thinking about times when maybe you didn't, maybe there was a time when you felt ecstatic, like everything just worked out. Like maybe you'll feel that way at the end of our podcast.
I feel that way already. Like this is that? You're changing my whole life here, Mark, just by talking to you. I'm feeling ecstasy for the first time ever.
See that? I want 10% of all profits.
we can work out a deal. My people will talk to your people.
Okay. So the first is you have to know the words. You have to know the feelings exist.
Mm.
For example, there are emotions that are in other languages that we don't have in English. And so some good ones and some kind of tricky ones, like Schadenfreude, right? Which is, the pleasure from watching someone else have misfortune. We've all felt it. We may not label it that way.
Yeah.
One of my favorites is mudita, which is a Sanskrit word for experiencing joy vicariously through other people's joy.
Oh, what a lovely word. It's a lovely concept.
It's a beautiful thing. During the pandemic, when I was ready to just like lose it, I would sometimes go outside and I live near a park and I'd watch like siblings, playing in the park and just having fun and laughing. I'm like, oh gosh, that's so fun, beautiful. And and so I've lived the vicariously, lived their joy.
Mm.
And so again, like I said, I think it's setting a goal, learning the words.
Yeah.
And doing the things, so for example, one of the things I learned, an emotion that I don't really experience very often, is awe.
Mm.
But I really have not given myself opportunity in life.
Right.
And so one of my colleagues, another psychologist, we talked about it and he's like, Mark, just go for some walks and force yourself to look at the sky and just stare at the clouds and make meaning out of it. Force yourself to look at the sand on the beach or the water or the trees. And I have to tell you, it did transform me for a while.
Oh, nice.
So again, we got to put ourselves in the position to experience the emotions that we want to have.
Is there a way or a risk, Mark, that overthinking your way to emotions actually gets in the way of the feeling? Like you're clearly a brilliant person who thinks a lot. I feel like I'm a less brilliant person who thinks a lot. I do wonder whether me overthinking stuff is something that I kind of, the metaphor maybe is like I've got a limited capacity. If 80% of it is thinking, that leaves only 20% of it for feeling. Now I already know that's set up in a false dichotomy. I can just feel it by saying it.
Yeah.
But I'm just curious to know how people who are in their heads may stay in their head by thinking about how I should be thinking about feelings.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds a little bit like a defense mechanism to me, that it's like safer. Right. You're more protected with your thoughts than maybe you are getting into your body and your feelings. So, again, I would say notice it.
Yeah.
Let it go. Notice it. Force yourself to just go to a place, where you're going to, allow yourself to be.
Yeah.
I'm very similar. I'm very cognitive. And, but I do give myself the opportunity to sit with my thoughts. which then oftentimes evokes feelings. Mm. So I just think that we have to, people who are very cognitive, brainiacs, let's call them that, they're hungry and hungry and hungry, and they're always on. And I think sometimes our most valuable experiences come when we just let ourselves turn off.
Yes. You talk about, you mentioned kind of being present to your body. And I'm just curious to know, what is the role of kind of that somatic wisdom in terms of helping become more facile with feelings?
Well, remember, our emotions, are a product of things happening in our body.
Right.
In our mind. And so, you appraise your body without maybe being conscious of it all the time. I'm tired. I feel energized. And so that's an appraisal of your body. It's like Lisa talks about her body budget, right? Do I feel like I've lost all my energy? Do I feel like I've got so much fuel that I'm, running at 150,000 miles an hour? But also, we're our brains and our eyes, right? We're looking outside and we're looking internally to make meaning out of all this. And so, right now I've moved to the countryside. As you can see, I've got these nice big windows, and it's beautiful. A pond on my property, which is incredible, and all trees. And I look outside, it's sunny today. We had a hurricane 3 days ago, which was not good. I got a roof leak. So that day, I'm like tired, and I'm appraising my new home as falling apart. It was not a good day.
Right.
But today, look at this. It's like I'm doing this fabulous podcast with you. The sun is out. It's amazing how ephemeral, these experiences are. And so we're endlessly making predictions based on what's going on inside of us and what we're observing in the world around us. And there you go. That's our emotional life.
Yeah. Mike, this has been such a wonderful conversation, and I really appreciate the work that you're doing. What needs to be said that hasn't yet been said in this conversation?
I think, it comes down to the heart of, the conversation we had about those four reasons or things that get in the way. And it's interesting, when I was thinking about a title, because a title is important, right, for a book.
Oh, it's everything.
Many people were saying to me, well, I don't envision, some executive in the airport, feeling comfortable picking up a book called Permission to Feel, right? Because again, this mindset that that's going to make that person look weak or feminine, in the male sense. Talk about toxic masculinity at its highest level. Yeah. And I said, but that's, I'm not going to write a book called Emotionally Intelligent Leadership. That sounds boring. Yep. Because I believe at the core of this work is that concept that we have to give ourselves the permission to be our true, full, feeling selves, non-judgmental, compassionate, self-scientists. And we have to provide that same space for everyone else. And when we can do that, I think great things can happen.
I'm hoping you haven't had to go through some version of the abuse that Mark experienced as a child, but I'd guess that you have had hard days. It is part of the human predicament after all. Life is suffering, life is joy. I'd be curious to know who your person was that helped you get through it. Who held up the mirror? Who reassured you it was okay? Who helped you find space to work through things? Who allowed you to come back to find the light in the dark places? And I wonder if you might take this moment to thank them. Now, you've probably done that before, directly or indirectly, but that's no reason not to do it again. As Chester Elden, reminded me in that same conversation I had with him last night, no one thinks, I've just had too much appreciation. I've just had too much gratitude. Two conversations I'm grateful for as part of the Two Pages project. And I think if you listen to them, go back and listen to them, they might enhance and illuminate this conversation. One is with Kim Scott, famous for her book Radical Candor. And that is episode 67, which is called When to Wave the Purple Flag. Purple flag thing will become clear in the conversation. And then a UK-British coach, Simon Alexander Ong. That's episode 125, and it's called Whose Heart Did You Break? And see how I just got into the feelings right away with that. For Mark, if you'd like to find out more about him and his work, his books, he's on socials, of course, but best place to go is just to his website, which is markbrackett.com. That's MarkBrackett. And of course, you'll find it in the show notes as well. You can support this podcast by signing up for the Substack newsletter, joining as a paid member if you'd like the cool bonuses, recommending episodes to people you love, that I do really appreciate, and leaving a review if you're so moved. Doing any one of those things would be lovely. Doing more than one would be just thoroughly delightful. And as I love to say, as a way of saying goodbye, you're awesome and you're doing great.